live. Thank you for joining us, everybody. This is the Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. I'm Willie Romano Pugh.
And my name's Jakob. This is a podcast where you know we do a deep read into each and every episode of the hit HBO show, The Wire. I mean, yeah. It's a hit, but I don't know why we say that. It's The Wire.
Yeah, self-explanatory. Yeah, you all know that, and you all know what you can do to donate to us at anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support. So go on and do it already if you know what's good for you. Give us 5 stars on iTunes and give us a nice review. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And special thanks to our current supporters.
Right.
Yeah. Appreciate the love.
All right. And with that being said, let's get into season 2, episode 7, Backwash. And what a backwash this is. All the chickens are coming home to roost, so to speak, in the wake of D'Angelo's death. We've got ripples for days. We got this episode opening up with Bodhi going into a florist shop and making a special request for the kind of flowers he wants on display for a special kind of friend.
Yeah, he gets treated to the back of the florist shop, where it's like, oh, this is your relationship with your work friend. But
yeah,
they were speaking the same language then as Bodhi was showed, you know, potential, you know, what, AK flower arrangements and so forth,
or guns,
rifles, and
BMW insignia.
Not to be outdone, the floral arrangements, you know, Bodhi shed some light on the situation, you know, airing out these complete you know, private business, even though Bodhi doesn't want to at that time. He basically explains to us what we presume to be a stranger, that D killed himself and he's just weak like that. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. This is another example of the show's strength in the writing, that a lot of people don't know the specific details of what's going on with other people's life, and they're just going to make ill-conceived assumptions about it and have to live with making those bad assumptions and never like learning the real truth of it, which is a great detriment to them. I mean, it's specifically detrimental to Bodhi because he could learn some valuable lessons from D'Angelo's downfall that could maybe help prevent him from meeting a fate identical to the D'Angelo's later on down the line. So slow moving tragedy we got going on here. We see the wheels in motion, even if they are going at 5 miles per hour.
Your current boss, who had you kill your younger colleague, right, definitely wouldn't be capable of anything shady as far as D is concerned. How could he know? I mean, but like paying homage to the street life, and you know,
right?
I mean, it's like you know, the closest thing probably we could draw reference to is, you know, the you know, white t-shirts with the RIP shirts and so forth, which has now been supplanted by placards. I noticed when I was subbing and stuff, like, as you know, it was like a badge of honor and a sick way for kids to be like, yeah, I know someone who got killed. It's like, that's not good.
Yeah,
but these flowers, that's the way to really you know, to go look. I mean, and you know, it was a hit.
I mean, his, yeah,
in a sick way. I know his 221 building was it was right.
Exquisite, yeah, it was impeccable. Very great. Yeah, very great recreation of the towers in the form of flowers. And
like, if anyone ever listens to this in its entirety, they could just, there'd be a pretty disgusting compilation of us just like, and then this person died, and then this it's like a death laughter track, like psychos.
Yeah, that's great. Speaking of psychos, Stringer Bell, he's really showing his penchant for following his own malignant path at this point. We see him lying and kind of double crossing Avon, of course, about the whole D'Angelo situation, but he's trying to play like comfort to Brianna and Donette. They're like beside themselves with grief and mourning uncontrollably, and he tries to play the good guy, even though, you know, he orchestrated this whole thing. This is like the continuation of us seeing him get way too overconfident now that the king is indisposed, where he's making his own decisions. He's the de facto leader, but he's making decisions that are, you know, in opposition with the real leader's desire. So he's already creating a lot of tension by going rogue.
Yeah. Even the DC you know, middleman who is revealed, who reveals it was actually his cousin, you know, thinks that Stringer is just way out of line and off the hook.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like it's not special that he's saying it to Stringer, because he thinks all Baltimore men in this, I guess, context are off the hook. But yeah, String's meeting with Avon. He's, you know, asking about the way Dee was killed, and, you know, trying to maybe mask it as feeling, you know, bad or
I can't tell.
Stringer's, you know, he's like, he's trying to cover his tracks, and by feeding him false interest in what's happening, he's really just trying to make sure that all his tracks are covered.
Right. And we know Avon's really going through it and like having a tough time with all this news, because he was confiding in Weebay earlier. Again, not unlike Bodhi, theorizing that D'Angelo was just weak and he couldn't stomach this lifestyle. Without knowing the tragic reality behind it, he's like sullying his nephew's name and getting Weebay to think that D'Angelo just committed suicide to like reach out from beyond the grave and like say fuck you to his uncle and hurt him.
Yeah, Weebay, I mean, he's got a full-on meal going on on his cell. Makes me wonder, if did he know that he would have access to this amount of food, or is this a new development? Because if this is the case, is this how he's living? Why did he you know, go all out when in his confession for another pit sandwich if he could get all this in jail anyways? I mean, or maybe in the moment he just like, he's such a compulsive eater, he just, I need my sandwich now. But hey, it's like he's not helping the situation, you know. He's, well, you know, he's trying to, it's like the food, as the food's comforting him, he's trying to be that comfort food for Avon in the moment. Like, you always did your best, Avon. You tried to help him. Avon's like, I schooled him since he was little. It's like, just leave him alone and he'd be alive.
Wonder what kind of lessons he was imparting on him. Idris Elba, he's a really great actor. He doesn't have a lot of emotions to display a lot of the time. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's very just like reserved and quiet, but we could see him like closely observing every angle that like how he's going to play out this situation. Like, you know, when he's talking to Avon, it's convincing in the moment. If we don't know the context of like what he's done, it's convincing that he is like concerned about, you know, Avon's well-being and all that. But we could read on his face that he's, you know, he's strategizing well beyond what they're trying to discuss in this meeting. And he's trying to play like, you know, three or even four dimensional chess like having these disingenuous meetings with Avon after he's already like talked to Prop Joe like after a funeral in a super inappropriate setting. Is like another great moment of his acting, that like giving Proposition Joe an honest chance to make his case for them doing business with each other, while also like, you know, saying hi to a lot of the mourners and like waving to them as if he's like, you know, commiserating with them, and he's showing his support to them, like, while in reality he's just like working on kind of like stabbing the Barksdale organization in the back almost.
Yeah, it's interesting, his reaction. And you can see through it almost, whereas Brianna, who's obviously devastated, sort of just throws her rose or her flower on the casket and almost leaves. She's not there for anyone but to mourn her son. So,
right.
And just dispelling any emotions that, it's, you know, any genuine feelings or emotions that Stringer might be harboring at the funeral. It's all it's all business. But Avon shifts pretty quickly too, right? When he brings them up to speed on Prop Joe's proposition. By the way, is this one of the first explicit propositions we have, or has? He set up Omar and String, I guess, to parlay, but it's like a very classic. Like, I have a proposition.
Yeah, so, it might be. Yeah. I mean, he gets propositioned a lot.
He gets. I'm sure he gets them all day. Like, hey, I got this clock from my grandfather.
I mean, Nick and Sergey recognize the value in trying to work out a deal with him.
Exactly. Today Avon and String, I mean, you could see the discord in their relationship because Avon is very adamant. Because I mean, we were provided some context from Prop Joe about why, Avon might never want to let go of his territory. He'd fought really hard and, it's just like, all right, back to business. Avon's still like, I lost, my nephew. Now, like you said, the king's away, but it's what little leverage he has. I shouldn't never say little leverage with Avon because we know how he rolls. But
it is crumbling for sure.
Still the man. Anyways, what do you want to talk about next?
So we got the whole controversy on what the details should do about the whole IBS detail and whatnot. Daniels is going back and forth on whether or not he wants to fold the murders into his investigation, playing politics with Rawls and Landsman, with Bunk and Freeman trying to get Sergeant Landsman to get Rawls to sign off on this. A lot of internal strife going on here with making Daniels's marriage hang in the balance. And I just want to say that it's early on in the episode where Bunk and Freeman are talking to Jay Landsman and they're like telling him how they cloned the computer and they're monitoring the shipping containers and how this could all tie into the murder investigation. They say like, can you talk to Rawls for us? And he kind of like huffs and puffs and storms out of the room. And BD Russell is like, is that his approval? Like, did we get it or not? And I really feel like in that moment, BD kind of speaks for all of us. Like, she really like lays it out there, like how we must all be feeling a lot of times watching this show, because like a lot of these scenes like end maybe like three or four lines before like how a lot of regular TV shows would end, where they would just like explicitly spell out like, okay, and this is what we're going to do next. And this is like what's going to happen. But with this show, it kind of like leaves you on the hook a little bit and leaves you to fill in the blanks of what they might have talked about after we left the room.
She's getting a dose of homicide politics and just why it seems like things can never get rolling to a rhythm that will actually create results.
Right.
But what do you think about the gains made on the dock workers and so forth as far as setting up surveillance with Prez and Kima? They venture off to a strip club where Prez was actually inside alone and he seems rather pleased. It's it differs a bit from his previous experience. I have my thoughts on maybe why, but
yeah, please do. You always got a great little analyses for these rationales, so go off.
Oh, okay. Claws up. No, it's just funny how he's like, ooh, Russian white girl's like pretty and Prez like, and then Kima's like, oh, okay, did you grab any ass? And he's like, no, you're a woman. Don't talk to me about. I'm so uncomfortable now. It's just I want to go back. It's like now you're having fun, Prez. What a weirdo, man. It's got like a little like serial killer vibe or something.
He really does. I mean, if we didn't know that he was so brilliant at the math and puzzles, we would really think like, who is this like kind of, I don't know, spectrum-y looking guy? No, he's that sounds really bad. He's a great actor.
Canceled.
Like, JTF. I'm just I'm just saying, like, stereotypically, like, he looks like he would have gotten, like, picked on as a kid.
Stereotypically, I don't hate him because he reminds me of looking in the mirror in middle school. No,
right, exactly. See, that's
I'm stupid.
I'm basically just like making a long-winded comparison to myself, in that both Prez and I look like we're kind of slow. No,
I feel it, man. You're on the ground crying because you don't have friends in eighth grade. Well, look at you. Prez, yeah. Oh, sorry. No, that's me. Like I said, claws up, Twitter melted my brain. So mental illness is real, Willie.
That's okay.
I'm good at creating scenarios. It's, you know, how I keep my marriage from prospering.
How you keep it from prospering?
All right. What else? There's surveillance tactics. So I know I was like, you have a beautiful way of tying all the themes and plots and subplots together. And I'm like, were Prez and Kima too close and obvious in their surveillance? What do you think? You know, it's like,
there's that. I'm thinking about that. Well, probably being outside of the strip club at this point isn't inherently dangerous to blowing their cover, right?
Yeah. Well,
but
it's like the middle of the night. They're like, you know, they could just be patrons, but if you don't have anything else to say, I know I'm just like making that decision for you by moving us along. But the docks, like,
yeah.
What about that whole plot at the docks where she's like, oh, I'll get, you know, we don't have a surveillance van, but we could get a
clipboard.
Clipboard, work for the power company for the day, blah, blah, blah. Suit.
Yeah,
disguise, and then everything falls into place, it seems.
I was thinking about that, how that like might be a little more risky, and like even when, you know, the truck with the container gets to its destination, Bunk is just sitting there like outside of the location, like right in front, parked right out in front, smoking a cigar the whole time. I'm like, damn, like they didn't. I mean, you know, again, yeah. We're splitting hairs here. This is the best show ever, but just that we notice funny little coincidences, whether they were intentional or not, or maybe we're totally misreading things. But we just, you know, feel like we can have fun in pointing things out that we've noticed that maybe we didn't notice before, that Bunk is almost like a sitting duck sitting right in front of
leading up to that, if this guy, you know, Sergey's a legit, like we've seen his capabilities as an enforcer, negotiator, you know, he has connections. So you're telling me this Ukrainian guy wouldn't notice that, oh, that lady just randomly at the docks, who I probably never seen in the power company truck, just started following behind me. And then all of a sudden there's these other cars. And then I don't know who, whatever they got going on in their unit, whoever was on gate duty, that guy is like, he is terrified. He's like, oh, Sergey's here. And he locks up the gate. He doesn't even lock the gate. He just stakes it in. I'm like, what is that supposed to do? And then he just starts running off in this awful like outfit, his leather coat. And
he's so manic. He's
hot. Yeah. It's like, so that leads me to believe that maybe the, you know, black man with the cigar in the car in the neighborhood, that there's nothing around there. There's just warehouses sitting out. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that guy sitting out front wouldn't be noticed because everyone is so like, you know, manic.
Yeah.
Like you said. So it's interesting. And then later on, they have surveillance showing Prop Joe arriving. So if he's at the top of that, you know, the East Side's distribution of heroin, why would he, you know, why would he go near the dope? Isn't that rule number one? You know, you stay away. It's like in the season one, you have Avon just, he's like cutting his girlfriend's, or having Weebe cut her telephone lines. And he's he's pulling over and he's making phone calls from all different pay phones. But then Prop Joe just shows up at a random warehouse. Is that the point of it? It's so desolate out there that it wouldn't matter.
I guess so. I mean, I didn't approach it from as studious as an angle as you did. But yeah, I don't know why Prop Joe decided to go out there if he could have just kind of sent his minions to do his dirty work for him.
I mean, he has like hundreds of phones, right? He's just fixing them all day. He could have found one to just
But maybe that's why he has such a close relationship with Sergei and the Greeks, because he's a very hands-on manager who likes to, you know, show up and show up for his employees, you know?
Yeah, maybe they have a social hour where he's like, Tovarish, and then they, you know, play some, I got to be careful here. I don't want to stereotype any Ukrainian games, you know, potential. You know, when the people we know who have never watched The Wire, you know, go through the entirety of the show and then maybe rewatch it again and then listen to the entirety of hours upon hours of us breaking down, deep reading every episode, a few years, they might have something to say like, hey, well, you remember when you tried to insinuate that, I don't know, backgammon was Ukrainian? That's false.
That's offensive. That's problematic. Yeah, what if we get Andre to rescind his permission for us using his cover art?
Yeah, you remember how I was like asking you which season you're in and I can shade it to like, oh, the sun's setting or it's getting dark. I'm like, that sounds awesome. He's like, no, I'm sorry. It's not going to happen now.
Nice.
He's a great guy. Shouts out to Andre. For a second, I was like, oh, no, you said you revealed his identity. And it's like, literally, we have at this point each episode a shout out. It's like you're gonna get 60. You're gonna get 60 of them. 61 now, if this is kept in, right? This will be 61 name drops. We'll get two this episode.
Yeah,
damn.
It's really good.
But yeah, I mean, like I said, Beatty's learning. They meet with Perlman and they learn you can't make a wiretap on dead women. But, you know, the war on drugs is, you got to tie it into the dope somehow, right?
Right. Getting a cold lesson in the inconsistencies of the justice system, that's for sure. And I love it how, like, Perlman was just like, don't you guys know this? Like, haven't you read Handbook 2BA? Yeah. Statute 107A396 or whatever. Like, she just expects everybody to she just expects everybody to know like how inconsistently consistent the things are.
Enough said, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. Does McNulty's get a
I mean, he's just like
over
before? he barely even shows up in this episode, right? Like, just in that one scene.
Exactly. It's like, okay, it is what it is. He's, you know, watching the boys play around in the tent, but yeah, this is it pretty much. It's an almost McNulty-less episode. It's great though.
I mean, I think it's almost like trying to make a point that like McNulty at this point is still trying to live the straight life and retire from hardcore policing. So it's just like, okay, well, if he's not doing police work, then there's no real reason to like devote a whole lot of like screen time to him, you know, if he's not doing what he's meant to do. And we're gonna show that like he's gonna be knocked off of his track to remain normal pretty quickly. Just Elena shuts him down pretty brutally in that one scene.
Yeah, and we see Daniels going to Rawls, presumably setting the stage for McNulty's return with the no pushback, no complaints. I get what I want.
Yeah, Daniels plays both sides of the fence pretty brilliantly this episode. It all depends on what information you're given, Jakob. He didn't know how effectively they could tie in the murders to their investigation. So he had to go back to Rawls, and then he had to bring this information up to Marla, potentially damaging their relationship permanently beyond repair.
It's withering best, but and he underestimated, well, maybe not, but they Lester got the best of him in ways that only Lester could, right?
He's very persuasive.
You got to think about it, Willie. You got to think about how you want to live your day today.
Yeah. Now, in the whole argument between Marla and Cedric, I find that I side with both of them on specific points, but I can see how easily things could fall apart with, it's the same thing with Kima and Cheryl's marriage. They both just want different things, but they're, Cedric and Kima are both so addicted and enveloped in their careers that they can't see the path that their significant other is trying to lay out for them as a viable alternative.
Keep going. I want to know, like, what they say around year 7, things get really tough. I want to know if I come to you for some Zoom guidance.
What? I don't know anything about this year 7 business. But
people, or maybe I made up that scenario at your birthday party when someone was like discussing it.
Yeah, there are a couple married couples there. I remember that.
You know, you seem like you got a handle on, like, I want to know, you know, okay, why should I potentially Venmo you to help, you know?
That's funny. But Marlis, like, Cedric was like, oh, this is the reason why I fell in love with you. You're this and that. You always, like, lead me the right way. And then she's like, well, I fell in love with your ambition. And I was, like, thinking to myself, like, oh, yeah, like, that's a reasonable thing to say. You're both, you know, trying to climb the ladder of success, and you both have got great goals. But then it's also kind of like, oh, that could be, like, construed as, like, a fucked up thing to say to your partner. Like, you don't just, like, love them for who they are. Like, you want to use them as a stepping stone in your own career goals. So I don't know. I kind of can see both sides of their argument a little bit. I think Daniels is being stubborn by wanting to stay in a really dangerous job, but at the same time, he feels like he was born for it. You can't really talk anybody out of something they feel like they're destined for.
I mean, he's ambitious, you know. I thought of my ambition, you know, like Wale, Meek Mill. Mama Maybach music.
I'll have to listen to that. I haven't heard that tune.
I know you like Glow Up.
That's a really fun song.
Yeah, it's but I mean, you know, he's seems pretty ambitious, taking on, you know, the deaths of 14 trafficked women who,
yeah, you
know, been taken advantage of and forced into sexual slavery, more or less. So
yeah. And Daniels always bring, like, if it's one thing that appeals to Daniels to ever do, like, a thorough job, it's his humanity, because it's the same thing that convinced him to take more drastic steps when McNulty lays out for him how Brandon got killed on their watch. It's like this thing again. It's like these women died in that can. Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, it's an unjust situation. You expect me to just, like, walk away from this?
Well, you know, Marla's more into the, I don't know, she likes the advancement in other ways and politics and stuff. So
yeah,
it's not a good look if your husband's out on South Clinton on the makeshift, in a makeshift detail office. It all dilapidated. So you want to talk about number one hustler, good pass habit, Nick?
Well, yeah, there's also Hurricane Carver is like, yeah, a little,
yeah. Yeah, we could tie all that in. So
okay, yeah, go ahead, go ahead.
The police, Hurricane Carver, they want to go. Like, so what prompts them to try to utilize their own money or what little funds they have? Herc has a maxed out card, which is, you know, he's not an impulsive guy at all. Big surprise. But yeah, what prompts them to say, you know, we need more? Let's put up your card, Carver. I did someone pressure them or they,
I mean, well, it kind of, I mean, it just,
they're wearing stripes.
It fits the bill of their personality type that we saw on exhibit in the first season, right? When they're like fantasizing, like, oh, when we bring Bodhi in, we're going to like blow this whole fucking case open and we're going to be recognized as heroes. So isn't that just kind of like par for the course that they're like, you know, they're the typical good guy cops in like that you see in like countless TV shows and movies that have to like work outside of the boundaries of the rules to get what they want. But in reality, they just like end up being idiots.
Work it, Willie. See you over there.
Yeah.
Police agility courses.
Do some slips and rolls, some defensive slips and rolls.
Yeah, parry the jab,
right? But that's what I got from there. That's what I got from their shenanigans.
I'm just thinking that you know, gas money or whatnot, that they'd probably be refunded if they drove out to Boys Village. This is a drastic step up to a state of the art bug. You know, this is like 2003.
Yeah,
going all in on some shenanigans.
Yeah,
so they yeah, I mean, this is where they, yeah, they, I mean, they plant it on Frog's turf on the block, and it gets tossed over the row house in a pretty iconic scene of Carver, reacting as if, it is my credit card that's been maxed out, or been charged $12.50, which quite a bit of money, I'm assuming, especially for a cop and whatnot. But
yeah,
whatever. I'm just talking in circles here, making no sense. But I mean, is it? I don't know how much. Maybe they're still putting money in their vests, right? I mean, they did steal last season, so
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they blew it all. They seem like they'd go down to the Jersey Shore, do something dumb like that. But.
Yeah, but I can't imagine that they're very financially responsible. That they're probably strapped. But yeah, great. It's like great comedic timing with how this all plays out, where they see like another Sobotka talking about some potentially incriminating stuff. So we think like, oh, they could be like onto something. But of course, the whole reality of how stupid of an idea it is to put a bug inside of a tennis ball rapidly catches up to that when Frog grabs the ball and starts bouncing it around everywhere and foiling their whole ill-conceived plan. Really funny stuff.
Tennis ball. Crazy. Yeah. Crazy Frog, man. He's got a little arm, like you said, they hear Nick, even though they don't know it's him at that point, correct? Because they are able to at least, for their gain, snap some photos of his plates and then track the truck back to the row house where Nick is, he's trying to be a bit slick with Amy, tell him some tall tales about his new job.
Yeah. His new job where he's getting, oh my God, $500 a week. Can you believe that? That's going to be enough to support him and his whole family for who knows how long. Wow.
Hey, three, 4 days a week, living expenses in, Baltimore at that time. Especially if they want to move to the county, I'm sure that could go a long way, but
like
super vague. I mean,
nowadays, like, do you think like you, cause we were both raised in like one of the most expensive areas in the country, the Bay Area. Like when you hear like someone is making $500 a week nowadays, you think like, oh shit, like how are you surviving? Like what's going on? Do you think?
I mean, if it's a side hustle, though, it'd be like,
yeah.
But he's not really working a lot. That'd be like, oh, I'm getting day subbing, but I got this job. Like I would have been, a few years ago. Like, oh well, okay, I'll take it.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously, not being a heroin dealer. But excuse you, Willie, just balling out here. No,
I'm not trying to like make it seem like
$500 a week.
But. But like
do you know the deals that I like get done? You know who I am?
But like 17 years ago, I can't imagine like if this show was made today and he was talking about making $500 a week, it would have that same impact on Amy, right? Like
yeah, I mean, but,
that seems like well, nothing.
Yeah. But inflation and stuff, right? He'd be saying, "Oh, I'm making $750 a week, 3 days a week." For a Greek guy, I think that if I came home and said that, she'd be like, what Greek? Like, where? What are you talking about? That's insane.
Let's get some specifics on this job that you have.
Well, here it would be like an Armenian guy or something. this Armenian guy has a warehouse, been doing some foreman work. Nothing going on. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. But that's just a comparison, like regional comparison. There's a lot of Greek influence in Baltimore, greater LA. And he's giving it all away, man. So Nick has, to his credit, wrangled the money that Frog was holding out on pathetic Ziggy, who's getting all sorts of pranks played on him. He's being victimized alone at the bar until Nick shows up. But prior to that, Nick had pretty much gone back to the same area that had all ended really poorly for Ziggy, albeit under different circumstances. Cheese is now you know, off his back. But yeah, interesting. We see the old lady who I believe was previously scrubbing her step, and now she's, you know, she's being encroached upon even further by Nick and Frog, and
right,
giving Nick the side eye and disgust and disappointment. Yeah. As much as Nick wants to distance himself from confused Frog, and you know, you're white. I'm a stevedore white. I'm not like you. He's just, you know, he's just as big a problem, if not more,
yeah,
as a supplier to Frog. So
really powerful little exchange of looks he has there with that older lady, because he's kind of like having to confront the type of person he's becoming that we've seen him like rail against so hard in earlier parts of the season. He's becoming somebody who he said he didn't want to become. So
he's still making, better than the project guys.
He's making some bad decisions.
I tried to like smoothly transition into Nick, but then I forgot to mention that the main reason I wanted to bring that up as a transition is that Herc tells Carver, you know, you can go talk to, you know, the lieutenant about these CIs and so forth that we're going to have to register to cover for our gaffe with the with the bug. And, you know, he trusts you. And it's just, you know, they're talking about ratting. I know he always liked to, come on, let me get a Carver rat take. No.
Come on. Nah, he's getting better. He's not as, he's learned some lessons throughout the show where he's not as backstabbing as he used to be.
Oh, is that the term we're going to use now? Backstabbing? No hard RFs?
No, not this time. Not
this time. If there's a time and place, I don't know. It's timing's everything. As you can see by my bungled transition, I'm lacking right now, but
I know we're kind of jumping around a little bit here, but it's kind of funny how like when Herc and Carver are listening to what's going on with their like whole surveillance thing, and Herc is like, this fucking technology, can you believe it? It's unbelievable. That's kind of like juxtaposed against the whole Rotterdam presentation that the IBS is getting on how to like automate their whole industry, basically, where it's kind of showing Frank as if like he's like having PTSD from watching like all of his jobs like slowly disappear.
Those sneaky Dutch, what can I say, man? They're coming for your workers, your work. Frank is not pleased, man. He's on some Yang Gang stuff at that moment. Like, the robots are coming, guys.
Well, it kind of like messes with his intentions of being good and whatnot at that point, right? Because doesn't this like convince him to get more in bed with the Greeks so he could get his union some more money, and he's gonna try to keep running and keep getting the canal dredge. He's gonna bribe his lobbyist Bruce DiBiago. He's hanging on by a thread here at this point because he knows what's coming.
Great scene there, almost akin to his union monologue, or I don't know what's rant about, you know, Tricky Dick Nixon and so forth. We get to see some more all out Frank here with Bruce. I don't know. I want to hear your thoughts on that scene and the dialogue.
Oh man, the dialogue in that scene is really good. I liked it. I liked it.
These characters, man, let me tell you.
So he's meeting with the lobbyist, and then he's basically like letting him know like they're not going to be able to get everything that they want. They're not going to get the canal dredged. It's still going to be ways off. And Frank Sabatka, you know, Bruce DiBiago kind of sets himself apart from like this whole scene, or, you know, of people that are more like working class and rough and tumble. He's like talking about how his son's going to Princeton. He can be whatever he wants. And there's like a divide or whatever. And Frank is trying to like tell him like, I know you back in the day, and I know you are like just like any of the rest of us, but we, you know, we're choosing to like be dignified and go along with what our jobs are meant to be, and we're all stevedores while you're fucking, you know. He makes a comparison to like the Tang making kids think that everybody can be astronauts.
Yeah. The ill-conceived plot to steal cognac, resulting in Tang. But yeah, like you said, cognac can't send you to the moon, right?
Yeah.
Tang can, but of course they all ended up working at the docks, so didn't help. But
yeah,
it's a powerful scene for sure. But yeah. Bruce wasn't pleased and had to remind Frank of his humble origins.
Yeah, with his great grandfather, the knife sharpener. But Frank bribes him out of the ass, basically.
Bribes him out of the ass.
Sorry, man, I'm tired.
Is that a term though? Like
he bribes
donkey ass or.
No, he bribes him handsomely. I'll say,
oh, okay.
The bunch of money in the shoebox.
Yeah, your size, right?
Yeah. And Bruce like does a moment where he like looks at the money and is like, "Oh my god, oh my, no, come on, you're trying to bribe me." And then he pretty quickly starts like giving in and pocketing that that change real quick.
And we see where this cash eventually, you know, like. The source of the cash, obviously illicit crime and so forth, but there's a pretty big accident
right,
on the docks that we see where
with New Charles,
the far reaches of the funds, we see how far the money reaches, you know, and how it can seem like on the surface it's for a good cause, as you mentioned, New Charles obviously losing a leg or having it crushed under some bulkhead, or I don't know if that's the correct term, but very heavy cargo falls right on him. It's a tragedy. So his family is allotted what we can assume is this money gained from illegal activity. So Nat is on Frank even harder.
Yeah.
You know, something's up at this point, right? They had a conversation where he was wondering why Frank was pushing back so hard on Ott becoming the treasurer or the secretary of the treasury, or basically he needs Ott
leadership
Frank
position.
Needs Ott to fall back for a couple of years to see his plans through. But it's like, what are the big picture motivations at this point? Just 2 more years of a cash grab? Is that?
Yeah, I mean,
things I'm sure.
It's kind of just Frank has the understanding, like, oh, I need a little bit more time of doing things the dirty way, and then like we'll be all set, right? Like, I mean, I'm trying to think, like, because he has like a sense of allegiance to the brotherhood or whatever, so he wants to like make sure they're well off, but he feels like this, you know, getting in bed with the Greeks is the only way to do it at this point, or the only way he knows how to do it. So he wants to try and make it easier for his successor, even though he's fucking himself over.
Exactly. Yeah. Nat sees it. He sees the writing on the wall for sure.
Yeah.
But big tragedy for New Charles. And we see all the dangers associated with the profession, and the story about how he got his name also alludes to someone who lost his life, essentially.
Yeah.
Charlie Banion, they scooped him off of the docks or whatnot.
With a shovel.
Yeah, and then this guy, New Charles, comes in. They're just kind of chuckling it off, like, he just lost his leg. What can he do?
It's dangerous job. I mean, it's almost like we see more workplace injuries from dock workers than we do cops in this show. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's equal.
Since you mentioned it, and this is a good feed in, actually, I got some stats for you that I might have, you know, shared after, but yeah, doesn't matter. Longshoremen, I don't know the exact year. I'm not certain. I think it was recently, we'll say. Deaths per 100,000, 17.3. Firefighters, 16.6. And cops, 14.9.
Damn. So
the stats say it is the most dangerous job out of even first responders. So
the stories and the stats. And just to I'm pretty sure we covered all the plot except for want to wrap things up by talking about how Ziggy gets hoodwinked into believing he's a baby's daddy with all Maui and all the guys playing a trick on him, where they the whole prank seemed like pretty flimsy. Like Ziggy must have been so dumb to have believed that was true, where they like mailed him the results of a paternity test, and they kept playing Love Child by Donna Summer over and over again at the bar to try and like drive home the point. Like he was just sitting there not realizing that they had been gaming him the whole time with them like playing the song over and over again and laughing at him behind his back. He's just one big button that people can keep pushing. So easy to trigger him.
In the midst of that, he's also sulking about how the package was my thing, Nikki. Look at me. I'm so competent. I could definitely, you know, I'm thinking of like a Omar, you know, quote, like something about puppies and wolves, which I should know off the top. But it's like, yeah, Ziggy, I mean, if you can't contend, not that the stevedores aren't, you know, tough and savvy in their own ways, but if he can't figure that game out, how is he gonna even contend with Frog, the mastermind of Curly Street?
He was raised by wolves, but he never became one himself. And then like you said, if he can't, he's like, he can't go toe-to-toe with a frog. He can't go toe-to-toe with any of the wolves. In the animal kingdom, he's just on the bottom of the totem pole unless you give him a gun.
Let alone if you ever met a bird. Man.
Yeah. Caw. Nah.
Just hold that card.
Let's start off with the Wire universe.
Last episode, there was a statement made in the bar by Frank when Frank and Ziggy were discussing, you know, like reminiscing on the life of the stevedore and the culture that Ziggy yearned to be a part of and so forth. And Frank was telling stories and they had mentioned that, you know, remember when Jackie Taylor got hit by a cop car, got hit by a car at the Covington Pier? And I was like, Covington, that's where Nick and Elena are real estate beefing, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But I was, you know, like, maybe there's a story there. I couldn't figure it out, but I realized I had read an article previously, but I didn't stash it. Attention spans, like we talked about prior to this recording. It's not so good with the Twitter brain melt and hell and stuff. But basically, in 85, there was a huge protest where, you know, similar to the themes we're talking about, jobs and ships, you know, being routed more so to Virginia, Hampton Roads, Norfolk, not specifically referenced in the article. But around 85, there were at least 275,000 tons of cargo and 22 million in revenue. Several hundred jobs as well that were routed down to Virginia as opposed to, you know, going through Baltimore, which led to frustrations. And then, there was a huge protest where it looks like the Baltimore, you know, port had utilized non-union labor for the first time in history. And there are about, I think, 400 non-union workers, as I just said, unloading bags of cement from Poland off of a ship from Cyprus. And then these stevedores who were down there, I guess the ship was essentially like they tried to board it, like 20 or so of the stevedores. Things ratcheted up rather quickly because they, you know, they're not playing around with non-unionized labor, taking their jobs and so forth, especially in light of everything that's going on in the work climate. And then a cop allegedly accidentally hit Jackson Taylor, who was 59 at the time, and killed him. So that was a major event. So I got to look back. Do you recall, like, because the way Frank kind of framed it, you know, remember when Jackie Taylor got hit and it sounded like a bar story, like, oh, yeah, got hit by a cop car. Ha ha ha. They laughed it off. But in this case, the real Jackson Taylor, who I don't know whose nickname in real life was Jackie, but very, you know, I'm assuming this is what the story was based off of. So, but yeah, after his death, everybody kind of backed off, and that led to negotiations between the union and so forth with local labor officials, and the non-unionized laborers hightailed it out of there. So, I mean, it took a tragedy to gain some ground, but yeah, just a little background on that little tale.
That was good. It filled it out.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've said that a few times. Oh, yeah, I got to look into this and that. So it feels good also to finally, even if it's an episode late, kind of tie it off. But what about, you think about the Rayford brothers? I got a little scenario for you here.
Oh, nice.
So they talked about, or String and Prop Joe were talking about how hard the, you know, well, I won't say the outfit, specifically Avon, fought for the towers against the Rayford brothers and Big Dennis Woodson.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about those names.
I tried, Willie, but I'm assuming that, you know, we had talked about the Downer brothers, who were a big adversary to Warren Bordley, who kind of a little, you know, comparison to Avon's unwillingness to, you know, cede territory and so forth. But there was a band, the Rayford brothers. There, I just saw a random video recently them performing. It was called A Wanted Man was their song. And then there was a guy named David Woodson who killed a cop in Baltimore in the 80s. So I was like, oh, Rayford brothers, Woodson. Like I said, I like to create scenarios, mental illness. No.
Yeah. No, I like your mental illness though.
Yeah. So that's my Rayford brothers connection. Some like rockabilly band and performing in Vegas a couple of years ago. Who knows? Maybe we even come across them at the Fremont Experience. Oh, see, that ties in Fremont. We're going to talk about that, but they look like they would be performing at like the Golden Nugget or something. Rayford Brothers.
There is that in the meeting between Frank Sabatka and Bruce DiBiago, in a moment of pure frustration, Frank Sabatka hurls a dart at the dartboard with a picture that's taped onto the dartboard. In that picture, Rafael Alvarez noted later on that he was really proud that this moment was able to get into the episode. The picture is of Robert Irsay. Just reading a little bit about him, he was the owner of the Baltimore Colts, and he was really hated by he drew the outrage of the city of Baltimore, because in the middle of night, under the cover of darkness, he moved the entire team of the Baltimore Colts to their new home in Indianapolis. So Rafael Alvarez said that, like, oh yeah, like at the time when this show aired, maybe like five people got that reference of who Frank Sabatka was like putting up as his, you know, spiritual target or whatever, like the target of his frustration or his rage or anger. But then, you know, of course, more people like caught on and wanted to do the deep digging, and they found out, like, oh yeah, this is the guy that everybody in Baltimore hates. So
I thought, like, oh, that must be some union buster or some like adversary. Those are like the ops in another union. But, right, there you go, man. Brilliant pull there. And yeah, we know how much they love the Colts, right? They had even though Simon, like we talked about, is not a football fan, but they had talked about Big Daddy Lipscomb and the bar, the stevedores, and what he meant, and just kind of, you know, former Colts player. But yeah man, that's those Irsays, man, you can't trust them. They moved to Naptown while everyone was in the middle of their late night slumber.
Yeah, man, messed up situation. Yeah.
Those shady cults, man. Since you're talking about Rafael Alvarez, may I add a little background to the interaction between Frank and Bruce?
Please.
From an article, pretty great article. We had referenced, you talked about how much you liked it. And I was like, yeah, I should post it on the social. And you're like, I did that a week ago because you never check social. I'm like, I try to just log into our Twitter, but I go onto mine and then I have, you know, hours of just spirals and it's not. Anyways, I got to get it together, man. But
that's the kind of podcast we're running, bro.
Where I'm a negligent co-host.
No, I'm not. Like, I'm as equally as negligent.
Nah, it's all good. But so from an article he wrote for, I believe it's patch.com, that was in the community section. It was like a spotlight on Alvarez's work, and he contributed a piece about the docs and so forth. It's really great. Check it out on our socials, as I mentioned. Anyways, I'll get to that. Basically, it was talking about how Frank Zappa, who I should know more about. You know, Frank Zappa, a native son of Baltimore. He was born in the city in 1940, and it looks like, you know, Rafael Alvarez, you know, who is an expert in all things Baltimore and culture and so forth, he interviewed Frank Zappa in 1986, and yeah, just about his childhood and so forth, growing up in Baltimore. And he said in the interview that one of his earliest memories was watching a man, an Italian knife grinder, pushes his apparatus and tools through an alley. And yeah, later on, Rafael, he got in touch with the most well-renowned or one of the more well-celebrated knife grinders, who was named Nilo Vidi. And he was an expert sharpener who really knew how to, forgive me, Willie, but make a meat cleaver sing. Sorry.
Does like 99% accurate.
I appreciate it. You're like, you know me, I'm an American, like all those accents. So it's tie into the conversation between Bruce and Frank and how he throws that in Frank's face, like, what, you coming at me because my son goes to Princeton and can be whatever he wants to become? My lineage comes from Italian immigrant knife grinders,
right? We literally were grinding.
Grinding. Oh man. Anyways, so you know, it's like basically also the main point was Alvarez stating that DiBiago in that moment was the voice of his father, because contrary to the, nepotism and so forth that's on display and, the debate of whether it is good or bad and so forth, his dad did not want Rafael to follow him down to the docks.
Right.
Where his dad worked as a tugboat operator.
Really powerful. I thought
that
stuff.
Was an interesting parallel, and yeah, it's great work. So,
all right, let's now talk about All the Pieces Matter.
I was going to say, I think Friday evening late is a great formula for our success. We're both like definitely at peak focus.
Yeah. But there we did skip over that part where we didn't talk about Kima and Prez finding out the hotel where these ladies are going to work. And we do see a little surveillance shot.
Yeah, they have surveillance, I believe, because, there's obviously maybe some deeper meanings, like, ooh, look at Prez. But yeah, he's creeping for sure. Like, yeah. What did that guy at the desk think they were? Like, they can't, I mean, a couple or just two, like, we need to go pee. We're just some wayward travelers up here.
Yeah.
Get to the location shortly. doing some geo investigations, local strip clubs, big part of the culture, man. Bunk and McNulty in real life, Dominic and Wendell, they allegedly had some strip club experiences, got roped into judging, what was it? Pretty pussy competitions or something that Dominic was. Yeah. Let's just say the commentary, you know, that's not the only place where it's horny talk.
Yeah. Right.
This was in print, Willie. This is print style.
All the I remember. Mattered. It's yeah. coming back to me.
Big. Was Jim True forced, right? Do you think he participated in real life? He was like, they're like, you want to know who organized these nights at the strip club? That guy. And then in the show, he's like, what?
Yeah. Oops, my gun went off. So do you want to get into Geo Genius?
Geo, yay. Okay, so this is, you know, down my list. I'll try to make it snappy, but since we were talking about the strip club, and you know, I'll assume that part was left in Gentlemen's Gold Club. That's the club that Prez was more fond of. It's out on the Pulaski Highway, and it's nestled up right around Armistead Gardens, which is the area with Chaps Pit Beef. So it's like, you know, I thought I had a funny joke, but it was probably already stated in that movie Night School, which I never saw, just the trailer, where they have a strip club next to the chicken restaurant or something. So it's like, I was going to say, you know, oh, you could go to chat, you could get a pit sandwich and then, you know, cruise over to the Gentleman Gold Club for whatever you want to do. But yeah, so, you know, we know what that area is, you know, around the demographics and so forth. So like I was talking myself into in a corner about Prez's, you know, level of comfort around certain demographics, but, you know, more of the white area, although pretty hard scrabble, you know, the old school white projects and stuff that, you know, at this time, 2003 would have been more diverse. But hey, guess what? It's also near something. Let me put you on the spot. It's near a specific, let's say, establishment where a character may have inappropriately or, you know, creepily asked a colleague or new colleague about maybe taking a ride out there to get a cup of something. What do you think? What do you think it is? Was that confusing enough?
Wait, you're talking about the Royal Farm?
Yeah.
Okay. Royal Farms?
Yeah, there's a Royal Farms right okay. near right near this strip club and Chaps Pit Beef. So, but there also are multiple locations. What I'm gathering is Royal Farms is similar to maybe like a AMPM. You know, it's a gas station chain, but apparently, so that's what makes me believe, what was Herc's true intention? Was it a joke? Are we being, I don't think one can be too harsh on Herc, but, you know, when he said like, hey, you want to basically ask Beatty to go to a gas station for a cup of coffee to do what? It's like, oh, I just love the smell of unleaded in the morning and Folgers. It's like bizarre. But anyways, looks like an interesting area. Baltimore, man. Maybe we'll have to hit a trifecta if we go out there. Royal Farms for coffee, a pit sandwich, and then maybe we'll just walk by the strip club that's still there.
There you go.
Anyways, let's get started. 221, that was brought up by Bodhi in the opening scene. Right. He wants to get his floral arrangement on for D, who, you know, weren't really too fond of one another.
They weren't close, but they were colleagues, yeah. You know.
Exactly. So basically, the building that, you know, he has emblazoned with the flowers, 221 Fremont. So I think it's a reference to the Murphy homes, which we know are very prominent high rise, and also I found out low rise project torn down in 99, but there was a pretty notorious building, 851 George, which I'm assuming was on George Street, somewhere, I guess, you know, like 1058 Argyle and whatnot, was another tower building grouping. George Street has got so bad that maybe they tried to do a little bit of Stringer rebranding where they just, they renamed it to Fremont House in, I believe, maybe the mid-80s. So I still think it was pretty rough after the name change. But, you know, they had a manager who said she saw a 60 Minutes piece, and the warden at a prison was painting the cells salmon colored. So she started trying to implement that in the Murphy home. So, hey, when people make those comparisons between the projects preparing people for the jail cell, I mean, literally, you know, I think that that manager intended, you know, she was a community member. She meant well. She just wanted people to feel more calmed in their decaying living environment. But yeah, anyways, 851 George renamed Fremont House. But yeah, Murphy homes, man, they were so rough. I mean, not only could you get killed in a violent manner, as far as, you know, gun violence and the drug trade are concerned, in 89 a 2-foot chunk of concrete fell off from a 9th floor building and killed a kid.
Yeah, I saw that. It's terrible.
Anyways, yeah, man, it's brutal. I don't know how that relates to Fremont House, really, but just, you know.
I mean, it's a good story to bring up.
Just how tragic it could be living in an environment. Not that there weren't success stories, you know, people coming out of there, but there is actually a real 221 Fremont, Willie, in case you're interested. It's actually a little farther south. That's you know, an address on Fremont. Near Fremont and Pratt. So I think it's a little bit closer to being parallel with downtown. So many ways to use 221 Fremont. Nice. I'm trying to keep this concise. I don't want to put you to sleep again.
No. I'm wide awake.
I know, man. No, it's good. This is good. Yeah. Like I said, man, Friday night is good stuff. It's like, what else are we going to do? Oh, here's another thing. Maybe you told me this in the past when I tried to get too involved in whatever, certain, not personas, but basically, I don't know. Maybe you've said, you know, you're white, like we're Polish white.
Yeah. Nick has his little moment with Frog where he tries to wake him up to reality before he gets a little wake up. Or, you know, reality check himself.
Whatever character Frog is out there portraying, maybe, you know, he's not acting. But, okay, it's just, I think context matters because Rapola Street, it's in Greektown, and Nick makes it seem like it's this, like, I mean, maybe just based on demographics, I didn't look too much into it. Like, I'm assuming, you know, Greektown, heavy white concentration or, you know, large amount of white residents, especially at that time. But I mean, it is just north of O'Donnell Heights. I mean, there are freeways that separate it, but we've talked about how rough that area is. So, I mean, maybe it has nothing to do with like your street cred being from that Rapola Street, but just more so like, hey, dude, like who, you, it's not like you had black neighbors or friends really like that growing up. So, but yeah, it's also a neighborhood kind of with the expressway or highway right through it, the 895. So I'm assuming anything with 95 and it's pretty prominent, strong highway. So that must not be nice. But Nick also mentions that he was dragged down from Rapola Street to St. Casimir's.
Right.
Although Nick says Casimir, and I've said St. Casimir. I've said Casimir in the beginning. Then I heard someone say Casimir. And then I'm like, oh shit, did I say it wrong? One of those.
Get your shit straight, bro.
Yeah. So I'm thank you. Okay. So I'm gonna go with Casimir because I don't trust Nick. Like is he someone, if I'm trying to get my shit straight, do I look to Nick and be like, yes, yes, this is how I should conduct myself? But basically my point is here, Willie, that 2 miles is the distance between that church on O'Donnell and Rapola Street in Greektown. So I don't know. You know, that's a long walk. I mean, the way you made it seem like you were dragged down with a snot nose, which I think is also a term that needs to be used every time someone talks about someone in a church, like, Stan, you're just a snot nose up at whatever, Holy Redeemer, and you frog. It was like the ultimate Polish insult.
Right.
But I don't know, man. 2 miles, though, that seems like a long. Am I soft? Like, that seems like a long two, like, to be dragged down. I'm assuming you're walking.
It's probably like an hour long walk or something.
For a kid, yeah, man. Especially, you know, I can only imagine a young frog. That must be like a lot of energy, right? No, frog, don't pick up that whatever on the street and just chuck it over a building. Yeah, so. Anyways. Oh, let's get to Rotterdam.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to really...
Let's see you break our hearts just like that presentation broke the heart of Frank and all his fellow stevedores. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, I don't know if...
No, you're good.
Maybe if someone ever listens to my attempt to pronounce things, that's probably as far as I'm not here to badmouth it. I mean, personally, you know, my uncle actually still lives there. Shout out to Schiebroek, if I'm saying that right. And then, Rotterdam, basically the largest port in Europe. It's located on a bunch of tributaries and channels that feed into large river systems. It's like the Rhine, huge river in Western Europe. And this is my point that, where I was a bit concerned. I'm going to have to pronounce this. The Neue Maas. So it's basically
I'm looking at it right now and I don't know how to pronounce. I wish I could help you.
Yeah, I mean, I should be able to help myself considering that I am Dutch where it matters on paper. I mean, you'd think like this wouldn't be the Dutch word to like, because Dutch, you know, it's very, I mean, this seems pretty straightforward, but yeah, that's the main channel that funnels in from the North Sea that pretty much allows a lot of this major port action to occur. There were 464 million tons handled at the port of Rotterdam in 2019. So that's up from 350 million in 2003, man. In what, 16 years, Willie?
Jesus.
Over 100 million tons, right?
Damn. Yeah.
Pretty wild. I'm like waiting for a second. Is my math right? No. You're like, yeah. But yeah, it's also the second largest city in Holland, opposed to Amsterdam. It's in South Holland. So yeah, actually, I'm pretty familiar because my dad did grow up not far. Like, the Hook of Holland's not too far from there. I thought it was, after looking, see, I could say the wire, you know, helped me learn more of like my ancestral roots. And so, because I was always thinking like, man, Rotterdam is, that's like the big city. That's kind of far away. And then looking on the map, I'm like, oh, no wonder it seems far, because you have to freaking walk or ride a bike everywhere through this goddamn country. It's like, you know, you're just like, all right, yeah, everything's just a bike right away. And then you realize, oh, you're trying to keep up with people who didn't grow up like, hey, let's ride our bikes around the neighborhood and play pranks on the local like weird Pokemon card shop and like terrorize people and whatnot. Like, these are people who this is their mode of transportation. So you're just like, what? I cannot, what, 20 more miles?
Yeah.
Anyways.
Can't really fathom it.
Interesting city if you ever get a chance. Pretty diverse city. It's also, I don't know, it's a port. It's a huge port city, obviously. It's regarded as like one of the toughest towns in the country. So maybe, I don't want to say it's the Baltimore of Holland, but, you know, it's a port town. I think they just by nature are going to have a little tougher.
Yeah, for sure. They're automatically... more masculine. No, <I'm just>
I mean, also, it's just, you know, you got a lot, maybe you have illicit stuff going down, although the Dutch got all those computers and robots, so I don't know how many cans are going missing and making their way into the city to you know, prop up the drug trade and whatnot. But I mean, the south of the city does have a reputation. I mean, I've rode, we went through there, but I'm kind of like Nick with the hood pass. I could do what I want. But anyways, so I don't know how interested you are in learning about the Newkirk and Broning Highway.
Yeah.
Well, there were, I know I'm just kind of blah blah blah. But yeah, basically the Browning Highway. It's pretty much just leads up from Dundalk to O'Donnell Heights. So yeah, it's just pretty much connector for, you know, as we saw trucks and stuff leaving the docks. But I wanted to mention that apparently the place where Bunk and the rest of the crew stakes out is, I believe, if I'm correct, 5605 Newkirk. And when I looked that up, Willie, I mean, there's no reference or record of that address existing. I don't know how addresses can be recycled or, you know, whatnot, but it seems like Newkirk, I chipped it over to Newkirk, which is another street, my bad. But they mentioned both of them. Anyways, Browning leads to Newkirk and the warehouse and stuff. And it just looks like it led up to 2400 block. So I don't know. I don't know how 5605 would fit in there. Come on, guys. What's going on? Can't just be throwing out random addresses. You know how we do here. No.
Yeah.
It's probably some mystery. Simple explanation that I'm like attaching our ratings to, Willie. Like, I'm gonna figure this out. Anyways, moving on, almost to the end here of this geo breakdown. The Fallsway prop Joe's like, your product sucks, Stringer. Everyone's crossing the Fallsway to get to the east side. And I was like, what the hell? What? Because I know there's a big stream or creek called the Jones Falls. And I think that this kind of, it's just in honor of that, or the expressway that divides the east and the west sides of the city. It's named after that. So it's just the expressway, also known as 83.
Mm.
So you could take 83, the Jones Falls Expressway, all the way north out of the city. It'll hit Hampton and also it gets, you know, up to the more exclusive neighborhoods like Roland Park and Mount Washington, maybe where we've been already. We just didn't, I didn't pin it down, or we didn't notice like big political mixers and so forth. Probably season three, Willie, we'll definitely get some Mount Washington action and so forth. So yeah, you can drive all the way to PA, York, Pennsylvania, all the way up to Harrisburg, capital of Pennsylvania, where my best friend when I was five moved. I watched the U-Haul drive down the hill and then never saw him again.
It's pretty tragic, bro.
I don't know. I mean, you're 5 years old. You're like, okay. Mm. I mean, it's sad, but, you know, we make new friends. Like people like you, you know, but I mean, I don't know if you're like, how sad would I be if you moved to Harrisburg, you know, friend, but probably pretty. Would I be 5-year-old sad if you moved to Harrisburg?
Or you, I can imagine you just be like, what do you have to do out there?
Let me tell you about Harrisburg. No, I met a couple from there recently at a wedding, but yeah, they said, he was like, hey, I was like the only black guy born in the town I was born in West Virginia. So, you know, Harrisburg, like I'm built for this. You know? Harrisburg's pretty, it's diverse and it's, you know, it's got some stuff going on, I believe. Enough about all that. Oh yeah. We finally get an address to Nick's parents' house, right? He still lives in the basement.
1405 Reynolds.
Yeah. I've been wondering. I'm like, oh man, where is that? You know, it's like, I know it's Locust Point, but it's on Reynolds between Clement and Fort. So it's like pretty, you know, Locust Point's pretty small. It's near Latrobe Park. But the Herc and Carr, while they're really cracking things open, it looks like they mentioned something like, oh, here's the tags, you know, 1485 Reynolds. And I was looking around like, wait, what? What are they talking about? It clearly shows 1405 in the shot leading up to Nick lying to Amy about, you know, his job and the measly $500 he makes a week. But that's a different story. But I'm like, how do they get this wrong? Or am I tripping? I don't know. I mean, they said it's registered to 1485, and unless I at this point, I'm mishearing the Geo to the point where I'm like manifesting these conspiracies. Like, yes, this is what I want. The block of Reynolds, that block of Reynolds only goes to 1475. Man, there is no 1485 on that street. So that's all I got to say about that. And before I wrap it up, a correction, Willie.
Yes,
I had talked about the lady who they got information from, the stripper who Michael Kay and Dominic more or less believe should get the Emmy for her work and that dialogue with Kima and Prez and Cheryl. Pretty classic scene. But anyway, I said that where she was from, Westport, is dissected like east-west, you know, the Westport homes from the other area of Westport by the 95, but it's not so stupid. It's the 295.
Man.
Yeah, the 295 goes, looks more like north-south, whereas the 95 is kind of on an east-west plane. They do intersect those two highways, but yeah, Westport on the 295. So damn. Apologies to people out there, and be more train guy if you're ever listening to this. Anyways, that's it, Willie. So we're still here, man. We made
cool,
it.
Cool, man. Yeah, that was a great pod. That was a great pod.
Yeah, it was good. It was fun.
Thank you, everybody. We had a great time with this podcast, and we're really appreciative of you sticking to the end. Again, just as a reminder, if you'd like to throw us a couple bucks, just please donate at anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support, and be sure to give us 5 stars on iTunes and give us a nice review.
Yeah, thanks so much. Helps that 5-star, and we truly appreciate you out there. Jesus. Stars, baby. Woo. Yeah, thank you, Willie, man, for bringing it home. As you all know, Willie loves you dearly, you know, as do I. We appreciate you engaging in some wackiness with us here. Always good. Let us know what you think. Hit us up on social, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can find us, you know, it's not hard.
Yeah, that's right.
God will not save you.
That's right. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, or just want to chat with us, reach out to us on the email, thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com.
Exactly. And I want to give a special shout out to my bud, Andre Tesnes, very talented graphic designer. He hooked us up with, you know, what you all see, the artwork, the emblem for this project. So special thanks to you, bud. Thanks.
Also give a shout out to Mostart, who did our intro and outro music and did the bumper, which is really great. Check them out at mostart.com.